Welcome to the Majlis, podcast of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project at Queen's University. Majlis is the Arabic word for an assembly, literally a gathering of people sitting together, and it was used for the sessions of learned scholars, philosophers, intellectuals, and artists brought together to discuss and debate. Our podcast intends to accomplish the same purpose of bringing together experts and scholars for discussion and conversation about the politics, histories, cultures of the Middle East, Islamic world, and Muslim diasporas.
You can find the Majlis on your favorite podcast site, including Spotify and Apple iTunes. Don't forget to subscribe and let us know what you think by giving us a rating.
Salam. Hello. Bonjour. Welcome to the Majlis podcast. I'm your host, Adnan Hussein. We have a very special treat today, an opportunity to talk with a filmmaker, a documentary filmmaker by the name of David Siskel, about his new documentary film, The Oil War, that premiered at Doc NYC Film Festival late in November, the 11th to the 19th. And hopefully will be distributed more widely at festivals and other platforms early this year. Dave Siskel, the director, is an old friend of mine from college, so that's how I happened to have the opportunity to convince him to sit down and speak with me about his documentary for the Majlis podcast. As I mentioned, a director, and this is one of his most recent projects, The Oil War, but he also was director for a film called Theo Who Lived in 2016, as well as other documentary and feature films. He's a writer. He was a writer on a feature film, My Idiot Brother, from 2011. And before that, also did quite a lot of reporting work and shorter documentaries in the Middle East, in Iraq, and also in Palestine. So I sat down and talked with David about this film, The Oil War, which is based on Andrew Bacevich's book about the U.S.'s war in the Middle East, for the greater Middle East. And what's great about this film is that it takes the thesis and the background history that Andrew Bacevich discusses in his book, and then also provides quite a lot of new file footage, photos to fill out the picture. It covers a lot of ground in a short period of time. It's an 83-minute documentary, and it's attempting to make a broad-based case about modern Middle Eastern history. So inevitably, many topics and issues don't come up or aren't directly addressed in the film, which begins basically with the oil shock after the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, and the oil embargo that is launched and the consequences on U.S. policy. And it principally is focused on U.S. policy and relationships in the Middle East, and takes what Andrew Bacevich himself calls an anti-colonial approach. So I had a good discussion with Dave. We disagree perhaps on some issues, but I really do recommend the film as providing an interesting starting point for conversation and doing a lot to advance some key and important points. For example, the bipartisan U.S. governmental approach in the Middle East. So instead of thinking about a particular administration's policy, it looks more broadly at the continuities between different U.S. administrations. And of course, in taking what it calls an anti-colonial approach, it widens the scope for political critique of U.S. policy in the Middle East to reach an audience that I think isn't always aware of the details of U.S. involvement as a colonial or imperial power, not only globally, but specifically in the Middle East. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. After the interview and discussion that I had, I'll come back with maybe a few remarks and context and reflections about, you know, what we can learn from the film and what maybe we also have to keep thinking about what additional context and arguments we might want to take on board when we think about the U.S. in the Middle East. Okay, so next, after the break, my conversation with David Siskel, director of a new documentary, The Oil War. So welcome, Dave Siskel, to The Mudgeless. It's great to have you on to talk about your latest film, The Oil War, which is premiering its world premiere in the Doc NYC Festival. So welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Your film is really a kind of 83-minute history of the modern Middle East and the U.S.'s relationship to it. I'm wondering, as a historian myself, educating young people today, teaching the modern Middle East, I'm always struck by how little people seem to remember what happened maybe even a decade ago. And when I talk about something like the Iraq War, it seems like ancient history. So what's the purpose of your film in trying to confront maybe our cultural and political amnesia? What was your goal here?
My goal was to, you know, to provide a different narrative and a different language for talking about the American military experience in the Middle East, you know, over the course of my lifetime. Because I think it's remarkable that we, in America, we don't even really have a name for that. You know, it's which means it's a taboo subject. I mean, is it the Forever Wars? Is it the, you know, you talked about the Iraq War. We don't have a name for, you know, the conflicts in the Middle East that America's been involved with that pulls them all together and makes them of a piece, which I really believe that they are. I think it's, you know, and so that's why I wanted to make the film. I wanted to, you know, try to change the master narrative around this in my own small way, and to try to give a different to name it in a way that I think can cut through a lot of our amnesia, can cut through a lot of our misunderstanding. And that I also believe, you know, that 20 or 30 years from now or 50 years from now, nobody's gonna be writing about, you know, like the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War. There's gonna be a name for this whole set of interrelated events on the same ground. And I believe that name is going to be the Oil War, much like, you know, the Opium Wars, because it's the, you know, it's the simplest, it's, you know, it's what I believe future historians will call this. So that was what I was trying to do. And it intrigued me. I mean, when I read Andy's book, it really intrigued me, the idea that you could tell the story as one, you know, continuous war. And that struck me as, from an aesthetic and formal point of view, the idea of doing, you know, the history of America's military involvement in the Middle East in, you know, under 90 minutes was something that I really was drawn to, because it seemed to be impossible.
Indeed. Well, I think you did a remarkable job of creating a continuous narrative that really emphasized and showed the continuities between different U.S. administrations. So one president comes, he leaves, you get another one, but fundamentally, the argument of the film seems to be that U.S. policy and its relationship to the Middle East doesn't really change in any serious way.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I think that that's, and it's one of the things I wanted to get at visually. You know, we're so used to, and in making the film, you know, people, my collaborators, we had to like sort of force ourselves to stop thinking in terms of administrations. We have this way in America of thinking about, like, well, this is what this Bush did, and this is what Clinton did, and this is how Reagan approached. And it's always sort of personality based and kind of like domestic politically based, but in the way that it was talked about at the time. And that's, you know, that's a myopia. that is, I think, damaging to our political discourse. You know, and I really wanted to give the sense of like, yeah, that there were different approaches. There's been different approaches over the last 40 years, but the range of options that these administrations were considering are all really within a narrow range, and nobody ever asked any first order questions, or even, you know, tried to query like the settlement that was made with the Gulf in the Carter administration. You know, I mean, I could go on about this forever, but you know, one of the things that you hear, I didn't put it in the film, but one of the things you hear every president say is, you know, how our relationship with Saudi Arabia goes back to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. There's kind of this imagination that like, it's always been thus. While we know that, you know, that was not an alliance that was formed. It was just a recognition. Anyway, I'll stop. But so that's what I'm hoping to do with it. I mean, nothing, you know, it's a very small film, but you know, you never, you know, I do believe that you can change, you know, I do believe that in certain situations, politics can be downstream from culture.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's the value of this film in some ways is not everyone's going to read Andrew Bacevich's book or absorb its argument and lessons as fully as perhaps he and you would like. But the film really does a great job of crystallizing and distilling his argument. And with the visuals that you provide, it really gives an impactful, I think, way of portraying and bringing to life and illustrating what he was talking about. He's the narrator for it. So I did want to ask you a little bit about the footage and about the visuals and what you were trying to achieve with them, partly because I think it must be a challenge on some level to make a film that is dominated by a particular voice. It's based on his book, America's War in the Greater Middle East. So what did you do with the visuals, with the footage? What were you trying to achieve with his narration, but then also with all the visual content of the movie? And what were the challenges there?
Well, you know, from an aesthetic point of view, if I could have made the film entirely with the archival, I would have been pleased. Because archival has a much more intense grip on the truth than someone's talking. You know, it's hard to argue with, it's impossible to argue with, and it's more interesting and there's a lot more going on for the viewer. But given the nature of the story, I had to have some connective tissue, and I also wanted to bring Andy out as a person a little bit. I wanted to show, in a sense, that the archival is all evidence of, you know, the points that the film is making. I spent, you know, probably, I don't know, 8 or 9 months looking through, maybe more, looking at just nothing but stuff from the National Archive. You know, there's a law that says if the government makes a videotape, they're supposed to send it to the National Archive. So there's all this stuff there, tons and tons and tons of just stuff, which I started watching and looking for, you know, stuff that I thought was really interesting and that could be really illustrative and that people hadn't seen before. Because if you're going to do a, you know, if you want to give people a different, you know, conceptual take on something they know, then you want to do it with, you know, convincing stuff they haven't seen. So I tried to stay away from a lot of, you know, there's no mission accomplished in the film. I tried to stay away from a lot of the well-known images and sound bites that people sort of hang their recollections on. And in those archives in the National Archives, I just found amazing stuff. You know, stuff that was made by the government for international consumption. Some of it made by the State Department. Some of it made by the CIA. A huge amount of these stuff that the military made for itself. You know, videos that the military made for itself, or that the military made for congressmen to try to get them to fund stuff. There's a lot of those kinds of military industrials in there. And I just felt like that material. And then of course there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of mainstream news media, you know, who are only in it when they're getting it entirely wrong or entirely right. And mostly it's entirely wrong, but not always. You know, and I think I found a lot of incredible stuff. I mean, I think that the archival is really is worth the price of admission, I should say.
Definitely. I completely agree. There was a lot of fresh footage. As somebody who watched a lot of news, watches a lot of media, is interested in the Middle East, there were a lot of pieces, clips, footage that was very fresh and interesting and illuminating. Sometimes I had questions about how to put it into context, where it was from. And as you say, much of this is United States military or government propaganda made for an international audience. One thing that completely confused me, but I just enjoyed, was the opening sequence with this puppet Orientalism show. What was that? And, what was the purpose of it? If you can describe it a little bit.
The film opens with this this short made by the United States Information Service, which, you know, who knows who exactly was in charge of that at the time. It's a set of marionettes, and one marionette is like a sort of socialist. They're in a souk somewhere in the Middle East, and one marionette is like a radical socialist revolutionary. One's like a small shop owner, and one's like, you know, the wise older guy who's like, you know, believes that, you know, America's really helping. And right. they have this conversation as puppets. It's just so priceless that that's what they chose. I mean, I think that the reason that they chose to do the puppets was because then you could dub it in a whole bunch of different dialects, right? So then you could send the same Our Happy Puppets show to, you know, Iran as you could send to Morocco.
It's like a cartoon, but even easier to make.
Totally. And somebody spent a lot of time making those puppets. You know, the puppets aren't bad, it's so indicative of the way that, you know, America treated the way America viewed and wanted to view and wanted them to view Middle Eastern, you know, clients, which is puppets, you know, and so it was just from an aesthetic poetic point of view, it really kind of like makes it happen as a cold open.
Absolutely. Well, one thing that it raised for me is thinking a little bit about the back history. You had to make some decisions about where to begin and end the film. And of course, they are also part of Andrew Bacevich's perspective, where he really locates the Carter administration post oil shock, oil crisis, oil embargo as the direction that is really framing this continuity between these administrations. So I had one question before I ask you broadly about the kinds of choices, but just about the prehistory. I wonder about the Eisenhower era. A lot of historians argue that it's really post-World War II and with the emergence of the Cold War that U.S. policy starts to take a particular direction. And that's not really part of the oil war in its most precise manifestation, but of course oil is still significant. You have the 1953 Mossadegh coup in Iran, you know, created because Mossadegh is contemplating nationalizing Iranian oil and ejecting British petroleum. And the United States ends up taking over from the British in managing the colonial character or the imperial character of how to control this part of the Middle East and have a more favorable government that puts back in the Shah. And of course, by then, you know, you have the basis for 1979 and being able to talk about this prehistory a little bit. You didn't locate it there. And I'm wondering what you think about the broader Cold War context that's more geopolitical and possibly ideological, in addition to already an early recognition of the significance of oil resources in the region. How do you fit that together with where your starting point in terms of U.S. Involvement in the region?
Well, I would say that, you know, for sure after the Cold War, you know, the world was splitting into two camps. But within the American camp, there were really important differences. There were the parts of the world that were, you know, considered to be national security, vital to national security, where we stationed troops, Germany and Japan. There were areas in which we, you know, said, if you bring foreign troops here, we will fight you. That would be all of Latin America. And then there was the rest of the world where it was, you know, there were, there were large parts of the world where, you know, America had not, did not pledge to protect a particular area. It didn't say we were going to go to war over this. And that line, like where we're going to go to war, in retrospect, we kind of go, oh, it was, they were, you know, the U.S. wanted to kind of, you know, control everything and, you know, be a global hegemon, which is true. But I think that's a very, you know, metropolitan view. And the reason that, you know, the United States created a military option in the Gulf when it didn't in, say, Central Africa or in Indonesia or in other places you might care to name is due to exactly one thing. And it's the thing that they said they were doing it for at the time, and that was oil. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's why, you know, it's not located directly in the Cold War. And I also feel that, you know, the Mossadegh episode, you know, it is a place to start because it is a place where the American imperial mantle is most clearly passed. But I am of the opinion that, and I'm not an expert on it, but one of the things I wanted to get away from is this idea that the United States, let me rephrase this. You know, in the Middle East, there is a widespread delusion among regular people, among really educated people, among everybody, that, not everybody, but a large percentage of the population, that, like, you know, everything that happens happens because it was decided in Washington. And I think that we in the United States have an equal delusion, all of us, elites, people in the streets, and that is that, you know, we can control what happens in the Middle East. That we have the means and ability to, like, push a button and change a regime, and we don't. And I think that's also a colonialist mindset that takes the agency away from people. So I feel personally that, and in my research, because I did some research on this, is that the Mossadegh incident, the Mossadegh overthrow, is often portrayed as, like, you know, it's like the classic example of the United States pressing a button and something happening. Now, I don't think that's the case. And I think that the CIA agents who were there, especially Kermit Roosevelt, blew up their involvement later in order to make themselves seem more all powerful. So I didn't want to start it there because it would, you know, I'm doing a military history, and that really falls into the history of, you know, geopolitics and intelligence, espionage, covert action, you know. I was trying to do a formal military history. And I also think that the prevailing narrative around that as sort of a start is inherently, I don't think it's right. I don't think the United States or England, you know, was the prime mover in that overthrow. I don't think British Petroleum was the prime mover in that overthrow. That's why I didn't start there.
Right. Well, you know, there's a lot to be said about, you know, that incident and its consequences, of course. But I think what I agree with you about is that history is, of course, a much more complex play of forces and interests that we reduce it if we just have this very simplistic idea about how power works and control, which isn't to minimize, you know, the involvements and the way in which U.S. policy may have shaped this region. You know, I'm thinking here particularly about Eisenhower, the Eisenhower Doctrine, you know, essentially, which highlighted the Middle East as a key strategic area for its oil, identified militant third world nationalisms as an extreme danger that had to be confronted. So in this case, Nasserism after the Suez War and so on. and you know, overreacted and got lucky that it didn't really work out very well when the Iraq revolution takes place in 58, and then they feel like, well, they need to confront Nasserism because it's spreading dramatically after Egypt and Syria have come together. And now if Iraq also has, you know, joined, so they send troops to save Lebanon, the government, kind of far right or right wing Christian government in Lebanon. Luckily, you know, it was an intervention that didn't really end up establishing the U.S. significantly as a occupying force. So you're right that it doesn't really emerge until this later period where the U.S. gets involved very directly with troops in the ground. So if you're looking at it as a military history, it's fair to sort of bracket that. But we would have to acknowledge that there is quite a lot of interests and of course, you know, shaping the region in various ways.
Of course. I mean, I wanted to, for sure, this is all true. And I don't want to give a monocausal history, but I do think this is a clarifying line of thought. Mm-hmm. From a military perspective, the intervention in Lebanon was carried out by the Marines. And the Marines were logistically incapable of moving more than 50 or 60 miles away from the water. So from a military perspective, like, not only did Eisenhower said, this region is important to us, but he did not say, and clearly did not say, that we would fight for it. And in terms of the capacity and logistics of the ability, you know, at any given time, the United States to intervene, it was reduced. We were really reduced to using the Marines in the literal. We didn't have a way in the 50s. We could build it, but we didn't have it to project our force into Iraq or into Saudi. We didn't have ships in the Indian Ocean. There was a time when America didn't think that it had to police the whole world.
That's right.
And we had different, you know, levels of how we police the world. And I think that's a really important thing. I hope that that one of the things the film does is remind the audience that such a world existed and is possible.
Right.
You know,
right.
It is possible for us to say, like, we are not going to interfere militarily in said region as a policy.
And that's indeed part of what you characterize in describing the film as an anti-colonial critique, right? Definitely. It's interesting. I think in the Q&A that people can watch if they stream the film, it's available until November 19th as part of the Doc NYC Festival. There's a Q&A with the organizer of the film festival and afterwards with you. And you talked a little bit about this anti-colonial critique being interesting and rare because it was coming from somebody who's an avowed conservative rather than the left. And you said something curious, I thought, at that moment. You said, and partly in explaining why it was attractive to really focus on this, is because it didn't come with all that baggage or with the other baggage. When watching the film, I kept thinking a couple of things, which was this anti-colonial sort of critique is, of course, not new. Andrew Bacevich has been saying it for a while, but at the time it was also being said by people who were criticizing the U.S., no blood for oil, you know, was the slogan. And at the time, it was completely dismissed as how in the world can activists, protesters, the left, reduce this noble effort, you know, to bring democracy in the Middle East and to secure the world from weapons of mass destruction to this crude, literally crude oil, you know, kind of rationale. So why is it that you think that it's valuable to emphasize, particularly from this military perspective and an anti-colonial military and conservative perspective? What do you think it accomplishes for your audience or in this critique that clearly hasn't been accomplished necessarily by the hundreds of thousands and, you know, millions of people who came out and demonstrated at the time during, you know, against the Iraq War in the 2000s, for example?
I'm going to take this in two parts. First, you know, I'm, you know, some people say, you know, preaching to the choir is like, you know, is good because, you know, people hear it outside the church, but I don't believe in that. And, you know, there is in this country, you know, our military caste, which we've created, is searching for a way to understand what has happened. And I think that Andy offers a explanation. I mean, one thing that I, you know, I have this memory of this kid in Iraq. He was a soldier, and his, you know, his like sergeant had died, you know, right in front of him. And his job was to like walk up and down streets in Baghdad, like waiting to get shot so that everyone else could shoot back. And he had no fucking idea why he was there. And he started telling me all these crazy, like, conspiracy theories that he wanted me to put on television, and I didn't. And I think of him, his name is Eric Christ, I think of him in sort of as the audience that I'm trying to reach. I want to, you know, bring to, you know, the military caste, which is searching for something like this. I want to give them this answer. And I also think that it can speak to a lot of different people, and it could speak to people on the left. But I think it's important. I mean, those people are, I think they're forgotten in general. They're, you know, they're courted by the most despicable parts of the far right. You know, since they're as time goes on, they're going to be the most important people in the country, because we're going to create this, like, you know, only a whole bunch of families who know how to fight. I think it's important to speak to that group and to myself. This is the second part of the question. I supported the Iraq War. I supported the invasion of Baghdad in 2003. And the reason I did it, the reason I felt that way was, you know, yeah, there was like, you know, yeah, there was, the oil was important, but what was the real, what was more important was the fact that all over the world, authoritarian regimes had been overthrown and replaced by responsible civil societies, from the Eastern Europe to South America to Southeast Asia to former Soviet republics. This happened all over the world. And at the time, my feeling was, you know, if the United States were to topple these authoritarian regimes in the Arab world, that the same civil society would come to the fore. And in fact, to argue otherwise, that, you know, to argue that, well, civil society is strong enough in the Philippines civil society is strong enough in the Philippines, it's strong enough in Latin America, it's strong enough in Bulgaria, but it's not among the Arabs, to me was, you know, a racist sentiment. And what I was missing in my understanding of what was happening was the fact that these people were gonna, that this area was going to see us as colonial occupiers, because of their own history and our own history, which is not forefront in our minds, it's at the bottom of our minds. We couldn't quite believe that anyone would really think it of us. And so, you know, for me, this is looking back and saying, yeah, you know, it's a reflection on my own political mistakes and my own political misunderstanding, and a way of squaring the circle. Because, you know, you can, as you are well aware, you know, and you can go to any Arab country and spend a month having dinner every night with one wonderful person after another who would be perfectly capable of, like, supporting a peaceful civil society. You know, it's the civil society is there. You can touch it. But the reason that we weren't that, you know, that those people were unable, the reason it all went wrong is because we didn't take seriously. We didn't look at it from their point of view, and or at least not we, I, and I think I speak for most people who had this view, which was about 80% of the American public, that we looked past this this thing. We willfully, because it was impossible for us to imagine ourselves as the evil empire. You know, it's impossible for us, we cannot be the people on the Death Star. And we couldn't imagine, I couldn't imagine, we couldn't imagine that others thought of us that way. Especially in the, you know, the bright glow of the end of the Cold War. And so, you know, I feel like this film, like for myself and for Eric and for other people who you know, have lived through this, I want it to be a story that you can live with. You know, that like, you know, this is what we took as the ground upon which we were having a discussion. So I don't know if I'm just ranting on now, but
No, I think that's very helpful to have that context. And I think you're right that, you know, as an educator, I feel like the real task is to be able to articulate and explain the complexities of history to an audience that doesn't already expect a certain narrative and to challenge them. So, you know, I think you're right that this is directed to a kind of imagined audience of people who need to hear it in a certain way because they're not going to hear it from other ways, but they could grasp something very significant about what's happened in the Middle East and the U.S.'s relationship to it by looking at it, you know, through this prism of U.S. interest in the region and the oil resources. So, I mean, I think that's very important, and I think it'll be very effective for that purpose. I think in
you know, I'll also say that, you know, I think that there's a tendency on the left to approve of, you know, as we've talked about, I'm making the case that the policy, the U.S. policy through presidencies really doesn't change. There are a lot of people on the left who don't see it that way. There's a lot of, like, you know, so much of the critique of the war at the time and today was in partisan terms. And it's very hard to see, it's very hard to separate that partisanship and even sort of, you know, partisanship within the parties from you know, the question of policy. Well, that, this sort of brings into, like, the things, you know, you leave out. We often said while we were making this film that it was an exercise in leaving things out, you know?
Right.
You know, one of the things that we left out, that's sort of very clearly left out, is there's really only a passing reference to the State of Israel,
mm-hmm.
Which I think among many people, and especially many people on the left, consider that our engagement in the Middle East has been in some way to protect the State of Israel and not to protect their use of their refrigerator. And I think that by telling the story this way, it puts the emphasis where it should be, even within the colonialist discourse, which is, you know, on making distinctions between the Gulf experience and, say, you know, the Syrian experience, the Lebanese experience, which, you know, was not what we're covering, making distinctions between different kinds of colonial experiences and different responses to them. So that was something that I liked a lot that appealed to me about the film as well. That it's silently a rebuke of the idea that the United States is defending Israel by its actions in the Middle East. Now, there's no doubt the United States supports Israel immensely in many ways, but from a military perspective, the State of Israel's raison d'etre, it's raison d'etre. The State of Israel's raison d'etre from a military perspective is to not be dependent on foreign forces to protect its state. I mean, that's the basic idea of Zionism. And it's held, you know, there's the Israelis, like, they need our technology, they need our money, they need our weapons, but they don't need our troops. That's not true of Saudi Arabia. And that's not true of Iraq. And it's not true of Kuwait. And I think that's, so I think these are important distinctions to make, because if you start trying to say, well, you know, I want to make an anti-colonialist critique of the United States and the Middle East, and I want to focus not just on, the Gulf, but also on the Levant and also on Israel and all the different ways that these, the different issues that these things raise, I think it conflates and confuses and conflates the issues with things that can be separated from and turns people off, because you're starting to go to an argument that is a different argument and that people have already taken hard sides on.
Right.
And I also think that, the left, there was a lot of no blood for oil, but there wasn't a peep when Obama sent, troops to Afghanistan. And, the effects of those troops in Afghanistan were horrible. There wasn't a peep when Obama, used our military in Syria. I mean, used our military in Libya. And there wasn't a peep when Obama, piled $500 million worth of guns into Syria. So I think that in my experience, feel that the traditional progressive critique of U.S. action in the region is also, compromised by its partisanship, compromised by its conflation of different issues. And I wanted to make something that could, be clarifying for people on both ends of the spectrum. I mean, it's interesting that Andy, who's rejected pretty much by everyone, the only people who support him are, the George Soros people and the Charles Koch people. So I want this is a place where the far left and the far right can kind of come together. And that's something else that appealed to me.
Well, that's interesting you point that out. I mean, I think you would consider, or you'd have to consider him more on the libertarian sort of right. Yeah, right. And I think that's interesting that you say that his perspective is rejected. Obviously, U.S. policy has not taken its direction from the way he outlines, the problem and its solutions. But of course, he did have an audience with Obama, so he's not exactly a voice crying out in the wilderness. Some people would pay attention and take seriously and significantly what he has to say, but even if they might accept aspects of his analysis, the point is there's no political will to actually confront what you need to do to change the direction. There's too many established interests and investments in the policy direction that we've taken. So I think that's a healthy consequence of the film to raise that. I think also what you just said really clarifies that in some way, some of the target of this film, another component of the audience, are the liberal partisans who are willing to turn a blind eye to Obama administration excesses, droning, drone attacks, and as you say, don't raise the same kinds of criticism that they will when it's George W. Bush and so on. So that partisanship creates a perspective that occludes the deeper structural continuities of U.S. colonial sort of empire or policy in the region. So I think that's very important and valuable to clarify that and to understand that. You raise the question of Israel. That is a complicating, that definitely gets into a complicated geopolitical analysis. I think you're right that one of the failures is to imagine that the U.S. is somehow subservient to the interests of Israel. That obviously is not, there's a dynamic, it's a complex dynamic, but fundamentally the U.S. is the global hegemon that is trying to dictate policy. The real question is how and when does it see, Israel as helping it achieve or fulfill its policies. That's something that the U.S. audience, the American audience, really has to take responsibility for. And I think that's what you're trying to say. Look, don't try and
blame the Jews.
Yeah, don't offshore this, sort of responsibility. You have to take this aspect seriously. So that's, I think it's hard. If I was to think about as a teacher, using your film, which, I think I would enjoy using your film in a modern Middle East course. And I think my colleagues may be interested to do so. I think what I like about it is that it has a very clear argument that you can follow and see the history. And so that makes it powerful. It's also good to be able to argue against. Well, where would you say this needs to be integrated into it, and what else would you have to say? And so my point on this would just be that when you talk about the Afghanistan component, which Andrew Bacevich discusses in the book and you discuss in the film, is that's also not that directly related to the precise Gulf control of oil. So that is part of a larger geopolitical or ideological security sort of notion and idea. So if you're going to bring in Afghanistan as a corollary for U.S. involvement in the Middle East, it seems that there are others that also could. But of course, you get unfocused if you look at absolutely everything. But the question for me is, why Afghanistan, not Israel, not Iran, not some of the other kinds of issues? Because you could say right now, one of the key problems of understanding how the Middle East conflict in the Middle East is being managed, exacerbated, and the alignments, of course, is the Iran versus the kind of Sunni Gulf that happened to be aligned more or less with policy, you know, Israel in the region. And we see that with the new agreement, you know, the UAE and Bahrain and so forth. So that's one kind of global way of thinking about the politics of the Middle East currently. That's not a part of it, partly because the U.S. isn't seen as the fundamental player perhaps in this, or there's a debate about because of Obama's peace agreement with Iran, that you could have different positions within the U.S. foreign policy establishment about, you know, what approach to take. It doesn't adhere to the same kind of very narrow band of difference, perhaps. I'm wondering what you think about that issue.
Well, I think that, you know, there's a lot of Iran in the film.
Yeah.
There's a Iran, you know, is definitely a player and an actor in the film. You know, I would say that from Afghanistan, like, of course, you know, the Afghanistan, and we say in the film that the Afghanistan was an episode of the Cold War, a very important one. But why did we choose to defend Afghanistan, you know, rather than Hungary in 1956, or any number of other choices you can make? And the answer is because, crazily, the United States was afraid that the Soviets were going to roll their tanks across the Anatolian Plateau and take the oil in the Gulf and win the Cold War. And so in that sense, that's why Afghanistan is tied into this when you look at it from a military perspective. And of course, also, you know, it's important to note that, like, the eventual insurgency was trained in this other arena, and their experience in this other arena was, you know, critical for their decision-making as they went forward. So I feel like you can't, if you're looking at the military history, you know, and you're focusing on, like, what the view from CENTCOM, which is kind of what I was trying to look at, Afghanistan looks really big, and Israel looks like something that's take care of itself. You know, Israel's like not something we need to worry about from a military perspective. I mean, that would be different from an intelligence perspective, or a diplomatic perspective, but, you know, from a military perspective, Israel is actually just a pain in CENTCOM's ass, because it's just a source of problems in, like, coalition building. It adversaries can attack it and then split the coalition. So I think that, you know, again, from the military perspective, it makes sense to leave Israel out mostly and keep Afghanistan in. But, you know, there are lots of ways to pick your way through this flower patch, and I'm just hoping that we've made one that's fresh and new and can you know, give some new perspective.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to, because we could talk, I think, forever about the last 40, 50 years of Middle Eastern history. I've been enjoying so much the back and forth and thinking through it with you. So I do want to just turn to the particular moment we're in now, given that you've made this film and you do have this narrative to present, and it's being presented right now to the world. Two sort of aspects that I'm interested in. One is we're in the midst of a presidential transition, we hope, you know, we're still watching how this will all play out. But, you know, there's already talk about cabinet positions, policy orientations, and so on in the Biden administration. And I think, so this is an interesting moment. I wondered if you could reflect a little bit on what work you think the film can do in the context of this changeover. You know, everyone demonized Trump. And I thought this also would be interesting to hear from you a little bit, is that the section on Trump was a little, to my mind, underdeveloped about how to fit it into the oil war paradigm and narrative. So maybe you might elaborate a little bit more how to situate that, since the film introduces it, but really kind of just says it's the same kind of thing, but less of a plan. But also now, as we go into a new administration, everyone's feeling on the left, great, we finally, you know, got rid of Trump. But when it comes to the Middle East, when it comes to foreign policy, how much is really going to change? It seems like your film comes at a moment with a warning about this.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that the film can disabuse, if they need disabusing, the, you know, the cohort of foreign policy intellectuals who are in my, you know, my age group, who, you know, are liberal interventionists. You know, I hope Samantha Power has a look at this and has, you know, does even more soul searching about whether or not some of those decisions in the second Obama administration were good ones.
Indeed.
I think that, I don't think we're, you know, I would love to see like a first order questions asked by this new administration about the Middle East, but we're not going to. The one shred of hope I see is, well, there's two shreds of hope, really. One is Joe Biden, in terms of the policy arguments during the Obama administration, was against the Afghanistan surge, and also had a really great idea, many people thought, for splitting up Iraq formally into three different countries, as opposed to a federalized system that, you know, a lot of, at the time seemed, you know, something he proposed, and the note didn't get any traction because, you know, God forbid we change one border and then all of them are going to change. It's another one of these sort of bullshit groupthink things. So there's hope there. Like, he's a guy who he certainly knows, forgotten more about the Middle East than I know. And he's shown himself capable of like having out of the box ideas. The other glimmer of hope, in a sense, and I hate to say this, is Donald Trump at the moment, because one of the reasons that we can't have this conversation about why are we in the Middle East is because of the position of our investment in Afghanistan, specifically our investment in Afghani women. And were we to pull out of Afghanistan, you know, there's a high probability that there would be atrocities, many atrocities, in the areas that the United States was in control of before it left. And nobody wants to be the president under whose watch, you know, young girls are slaughtered in their schools by the Taliban in Kabul. And that could happen. But, so the weird, and I think that's something that I think my, you know, my view is, you know, that's something that in a sense we're going to have to let the Afghans sort at some point. Whether or not there's atrocities in Kabul is going to have to be, it's going to be decided by the Afghanis. We're only putting off that decision by staying. And it's possible that, you know, Donald Trump will take this incredibly politically unattractive action of pulling out all of our troops from Afghanistan against the advice of everybody in and outside the Pentagon. He would take the heat then for the, you know, if disaster were to follow, because whenever we leave, there's a very good chance that disaster is going to follow. And so to me, that's a dark glimmer of hope, but it's a glimmer of hope. I mean, you know, when you take this idea seriously, you quickly get to questions like that. And, that's another reason why I don't think that, you know, that we're going to make any changes, is because there's so many people in the Middle East who are dependent on their physical security for us at the moment, that it's going to be, and right as it should be, very difficult to abandon those people or to resettle them. But these are the choices we're going to have to make if Afghanistan has any hope of peace.
Well, that is a dark glimmer, I have to say. But that's where we are at this stage. And these are the kinds of issues and questions we need to think about the U.S.'s role and impact and its consequences, which is something that needs to be thought about more. So I really appreciate you contributing to that discussion, to that debate, with this film. Thanks so much, David.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back. This is Adnan Hussein, just providing a little bit of commentary and context after my discussion with David Siskel, director of a new documentary film, The Oil War. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I certainly did. There were a lot of interesting points that came up, both in the film, but also in my discussion with David Siskel. And I just wanted to follow up with a few points while acknowledging some really excellent work in this film. I think it will have a potential public impact if people watch it in the American audience. I think it's an extremely well-made film, visually very engaging, which I think is a challenge when you have a long documentary or feature length sort of documentary, particularly with one main narrator and voice. It really was a feat of filmmaking to put together the footage, the documents, the images, to have that as a visual running commentary on the narration and make the historical story and unfolding and the analysis provided by Andrew Bacevich a lot more engaging for the period of time. It covers a lot of ground, as I mentioned, and so there are some choices that had to be made that I think it's worth thinking about and talking about a little bit further. But also that the strength of the film in some ways is that it has this one major voice based on the work of Andrew Bacevich that gives it a coherence so that it can cover so much ground with, as I say, some kind of coherent story and argument that's being made. I do think at the same time, though, that that is a limitation in some ways of the film, that it is univocal. And I think in some ways that the film could have included a little bit more about critiques of his arguments that, have been published or discussed, and find some people to add a bit more of a dialogic discussion about the nature of U.S. policy and foreign policy in the Middle East. It's not as if he's an unknown figure, obviously. His ideas have been discussed and debated in the public sphere to some extent. If they've been made marginal, that itself is interesting. But I would argue that the film really also excluded a lot of left voices that actually made many of these arguments, as well as other ones, prior to the internal U.S. foreign policy establishment's own possible critique, or the military establishment that Bacevich in some ways represents, this internal view on U.S. foreign policy. It comes a little bit late to this sort of critique of U.S. interventionist policy. So it would have been useful in some ways to include those other voices and that other kind of analysis. And the fact that it isn't present in this film and more broadly in media is itself, I think, rather telling about how left voices, left criticism, anti-colonial and anti-imperial left criticism is not taken that seriously and is marginalized. So that's certainly an issue. I think, in addition, it would have been useful to also have more voices from the people, or at least a perspective of the Middle East. I understand that the main focus is U.S. foreign policy, so it makes sense to begin and start with military and foreign policy criticism within the United States. I think, however, for it to make a compelling argument and really educate the American public, I would have loved to have had at least a little bit more of a sense of what some of the consequences on the region itself have been of U.S. intervention and war over the last almost 50 years that the film is taking as a historical period defined by the oil war. So that would have been useful. But of course, this is a short film that's covering a lot of ground. Some choices are going to be made, and things are not going to be treated in that same level of detail. So things like the Arab Spring, for example, and the U.S. role, I think in particular that it would have been useful to point out or mention if you had more time and were able to document the way in which oil policy, energy policy, tended to inform and influence the U.S. role would be to take, for example, the remarks that Obama makes in his famous Cairo speech about the change in regime, the Arab Spring, the effort to democratize the Middle East, that people rising up all over, starting in Tunisia and then elsewhere, we're hoping for and working toward. You have to also think about the case of Bahrain, one of these oil principalities in the Gulf, where the United States has its Fifth Fleet and where an uprising started. And the United States, of course, pretty predictably, was not at all supportive of the people's wish to change their system of government. And that shows how U.S. foreign policy is rooted very much in these material and geopolitical concerns that often are contradictory to democratization and the other sorts of political ideals and values that we might claim and that were certainly exploited for justifications for interventions in Afghanistan, in Iraq, by the neocons that formulated policy under the Bush administration, for example. So that's certainly another issue that would be worth thinking about a little further if you have more scope within the film. You can't do it perhaps in this film, but if you're watching the film or teaching the film, it's useful perhaps to bring up some of these other contexts and examples. Another key issue, of course, is the place of Israel in this story. It is pretty much ignored, and we did discuss this a little bit, and Dave talked about the reasons why he didn't think it was relevant in the frame that he wanted to emphasize here. I do think if you're going to start in the early 70s with the oil embargo, it's obviously a response to the 1973 war, and so it doesn't really make sense to exclude a discussion of U.S. support for Israel and the responses and consequences of that in the region. If you're going to talk about the modern Middle East, not discussing Israel in some serious fashion seems like not only a major lacuna, but a real analytical problem in how it affects the story that you might actually be telling. And I think this is a larger concern that academics and scholars and activists have about, for example, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism that includes many examples that would limit or characterize criticism of Israel as a form of anti-Semitism, Israeli government policy. So there's a reluctance already to integrate that into the broader story. And of course, I think that there's many opportunities along the way to have focused on what relationship that might have had in U.S. involvement in the Middle East. I do think, however, that some of the perspectives that tend to emphasize Israel and the lobby on behalf of it as politically decisive runs afoul of history. I think the broader point is that the U.S. is the imperial hegemon in the Middle East, and that Israel is its ally, and it can be restrained and disciplined and has to try and accord with U.S. policy. There are ways, of course, where we might see agency from Israeli pro-Israeli policies being put into effect, but I think you have to understand that in the larger context of the United States as the driver of policy in the Middle East. And this was a real failing, I think, in the kind of analysis in 2007, this book by two political scientists, Mearsheimer and Walt, called The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, that really tried to portray and represent the failings or the problems of U.S. involvement and intervention in the Middle East as a result of Israel's, you know, all-powerful and influential lobby. Now, it may in fact be a very influential and effective way of informing U.S. policy, but they really lost sight of the fact that the U.S. decisions and choices and the major interventions are because of U.S. decisions, not because of these sorts of political lobbying and so on. You have to understand the relationship, I think, in terms of power a little bit more effectively and identify that the United States has been the principal actor and agent in this. I guess the last thing that I would say in this reflection on the really interesting film that stimulated a lot of thoughts, and I think we had a great discussion, is that in terms of context, I did raise the fact that that there might be a longer history to the oil war, and that it is worth, if you're going to teach and present and discuss this film, it's worth reflecting on earlier 20th century developments and understanding that that you can make the argument for U.S. colonial and imperial involvement and using an anti-colonial perspective if you also link it to British and French involvement in the Middle East during the Mandate period and even before, where parts of the Middle East and Islamic world, huge parts of the Middle East and Islamic world were under European colonial control. And you can see that the 1950s policy, where the United States becomes the major global superpower and is waging a Cold War with the Soviet Union and its allies for influence and control of the global order, that the United States adopts a lot of colonial approaches and policies, particularly under Eisenhower. This response to militant third world nationalism as a danger that has to be rolled back ends up informing U.S. policy, particularly in a place like Iran with the 1953 coup against Mossadegh, a nationalist Iranian government that wanted to control Iran's own oil resources. Since that time, I think you can say that there is a much longer history of U.S. involvement, and oil plays a major role. The competition and conflict over control of this important resource certainly drives U.S. policy even before the oil embargo of the early 1970s, in a very serious way. I guess lastly, I think for areas for further discussion that will be interesting, is to talk a little bit about whether recognition of the dangers of fossil fuels and move toward sustainable, renewable alternative sources of energy will end up having a major effect or consequence on U.S. policy and involvement in the Middle East. And if it does so, will there be any understanding of the terrible consequences and destruction that the U.S. oil war, if we want to adopt that framework, has caused in the Middle East, on the people of the Middle East? The film really didn't discuss very much, as I said, how this has affected people in that region, their politics, their economy, their society, the devastating loss of life, as a result of these wars in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and elsewhere, places like Libya, what's happened there. These were sort of threads of analysis that the film couldn't really take up, but I also think perspectivally it would have been useful to acknowledge on some level if the U.S. does end up withdrawing moving towards less involvement and less military control of the region, takes its bases out and so on, is there going to be an awareness and an understanding that this region has suffered dramatically as a result of 50 years of very intensive U.S. involvement, and we could say much longer even than that? What kind of responsibility does the United States and its people have for the tragic conditions and response, tragic conditions and the situation in the Middle East? So anyway, again, I do encourage you to check out this film when it becomes more widely available. I think it's worth using in courses to talk about, with other materials. I think you could have a very interesting and useful, fruitful dialogue. And I do think that it will be very useful for the broad American public to watch this film, to think about it. And I think it'll be effective in the sense that the kind of critique that it's offering and the analysis that it's offering is one that will seem to be coming from a very authoritative source in a former U.S. military figure, Andrew Bacevich, who was a colonel and served in the military, who lost a son, who was a casualty in Iraq. For those reasons, it may be possible to introduce some useful ideas into American consciousness and political discussion more broadly than has been the case up to this point. So there are a lot of good things about the film. And as I said, it's a really, really well-made film, very engaging one, visually interesting. And I think it raises some very important and valuable points for further discussion. So again, I hope you do check it out, and I hope you enjoyed my discussion. And look for a new episode of The Mudgeless coming soon. Thanks very much. All the best, everyone.
Thank you for joining us in The Mudgeless, a podcast by MSGP. Muslim Society's Global Perspectives, or MSGP, is an initiative at Queen's University dedicated to connecting the complex history of Islamic societies with the contemporary world. You can connect, learn more, and support us by checking out our website, www.queensu.ca/MSGP, and stay up to date with our events by following us on Twitter at MSGPQU and on our Facebook, MSGPQU. You can also follow our YouTube channel, The Mudgeless.